What drives millions of people to greet a foreign army as liberators? In June 1941, as German tanks rolled into Soviet territory, something astonishing happened. Vast numbers of Soviet citizens welcomed them with open arms. After enduring collectivization's horrors, engineered famines, and Stalin's Great Terror that had already imprisoned 15 million people, the instinct to embrace anyone opposing Stalin made terrible sense. The military catastrophe that followed was unprecedented. 300,000 soldiers surrendering simultaneously, entire fronts collapsing faster than at any point in Russia's thousand-year history. By December, 60 million Soviet citizens had slipped from Stalin's grasp. Stalin's desperation became unmistakable when he begged Churchill for British divisions on Soviet soil, an unthinkable humiliation for a communist leader. Throughout occupied regions, anti-Stalin resistance flourished organically. Major Kononov announced he was joining a liberation army to overthrow Stalin, and his entire regiment followed. At one POW camp, 4,000 out of 5,000 prisoners volunteered to join him. The Lokot-Bryansky region, home to over a million people, established its own autonomous Russian administration before Germans even arrived. Villages greeted invaders with bread and salt. Even as late as 1943, tens of thousands fled westward with retreating Germans rather than remain under communism. This movement resembled a second Pugachev rebellion in its elemental force and popular support, far more authentically a people's uprising than the intelligentsia's liberation movement of 1900-1917. Yet it was destined to be branded as treason, raising an uncomfortable question: can Russians use foreign support during wartime for seemingly noble ends? Everyone cries no. Yet what about Lenin's sealed German carriage or the Bolsheviks' trainloads of food and gold to Wilhelm in 1918? Why didn't millions of political prisoners revolt? The answer lies in the chasm between Tsarist repression and Soviet mechanized terror. Under the Tsars, real limitations existed. Decembrist soldiers weren't executed. Vera Zosilich, who shot the police chief, was acquitted by jury. Despite 7 assassination attempts against Alexander II, only 5 were executed. Lenin himself, brother of a would-be regicide, was admitted to Kazan University. When expelled for organizing, he wasn't shot, but sent to his family estate. His exile to Minnesinx was comfortable. He hunted, ate well, and wrote scholarly works. The contrast with Stalin's era is absolute. When Tukhachevsky was arrested, his entire extended family was destroyed. Brothers, sisters, spouses arrested, his wife shot in a camp, his mother reduced to begging. Under the Tsars, a revolutionary's relatives never suffered. Without independent public opinion, which existed under the Tsars but was obliterated under Stalin, there could be no protection against mass extermination. When political prisoner Nadezhda Sigata faced corporal punishment under the Tsars, she and 3 others took poison in protest and died. The result? Corporal punishment was abolished forever. But in Soviet camps, such sacrifices vanished without trace. No news leaked out. No public outrage followed. No change came. After 6 years of imprisonment, Ekibastu's camp brought strange clarity, learning bricklaying, then smelting trades that shaped character and provided mental space for composing poetry while surrounded by guards with Tommy guns. But how does one write in a special camp? Unlike Tsarist prisons where writing was permitted, Soviet camps made it extraordinarily dangerous. Memory became the only safe repository. Short passages were composed, memorized, and immediately burned. In prison cells, broken matches tracked lines. A bread rosary from Lithuanian Catholics with specially shaped beads counted verses, hidden in mittens through searches. 3 times, discovery nearly meant disaster. Senior warder Tatarin found writing near the boundary wire. A guard caught 60 lines but tore up the paper, thinking it foolish. Another time, being grabbed in the dark, the poem "The Mason" was discarded just in time. When they found another fragment, the bold claim that it was Fardovsky's Vasily Torkin was accepted. Writing continued, in winter warming up shacks, in summer on scaffolding between barrow loads of mortar, living in a dream, mentally composing verses like fitting bricks in a wall, escape the warders couldn't detect. This secret was maturing in other lonely breasts across the archipelago, destined to emerge into future Russian literature. Georgi Pavlovich Tenno's highest praise was calling a prisoner a committed escaper, someone who spent every waking moment planning freedom despite brutal consequences. Bullet-riddled bodies displayed as warnings, severed heads and duffel bags, beaten escapers paraded publicly. Young guards carrying Tommy guns formed a silent and deadly brotherhood with prisoners during twice-daily marches. The system's cunning lay in enforced ignorance. Guards were forbidden to know prisoners as individuals, with simothy punishable as treason. Political instructors portrayed prisoners as dangerous enemies, concealing that many were imprisoned for religious beliefs or nothing at all. Guards had virtually unlimited license to kill, shooting prisoners for crossing invisible boundaries, sometimes lured across by cigarette offers. The system incentivized killings with rewards, a month's pay or leave, creating perverse competition. You killed somebody and bought butter, so I'll kill somebody and buy butter too. Some escapes were marvels of ingenuity. In 1951, Stepan survived alone in the desert by hunting gophers and jerboas, sucking their blood and roasting their flesh. When a Kazakh horseman tried to lasso him, Stepan struck him and took his horse. Stalin's special camps backfired spectacularly. Concentrating political prisoners revealed their collective strength. Without criminal thieves, pilfering stopped. Prisoners could leave belongings unguarded. Trust flourished. Once there was no pilfering, people began to look at their neighbors kindly and without suspicion. With 25-year sentences and nothing to lose, prisoners spoke freely. The old mentality, you die first, I'll wait, crumbled. Divisions between trustees and workers dissolved. A revolutionary thought emerged. How could things be changed so that instead of us running from them, they would run from us? The age of escapes ended. The age of rebellion began. Uprisings came in waves. The 1942 Ratunian affair saw hundreds disarm guards and escape as partisans. The 1948 uprising at Railway Site No. 501 saw ex-soldiers rally under a one-eyed ex-colonel, killing guards and opening camp gates. Most extraordinary was Kenger in 1954. After Stalin's death, authorities hesitated to shoot. Kapitan Kuznetsov's political line prevailed. Anti-Sovietism will be the death of us. Our salvation lies in loyalty. Over the mess hall, they raised a white flag with black border and red cross, the maritime distress signal meaning ship in distress, women and children on board. A 12-member commission organized departments for propaganda, services, food, security, military affairs, and technical matters. Prisoners fortified positions with mud brick barricades and barbed wire. The technical department created secret premises marked high tension 100,000 volts, generating rumors of chemical weapons. Window bars became pikes. Smiths forged knives and halberds before authorities cut power. Thieves behaved with unexpected decency, no rapes, violence, or raids on food stores. The camp maintained unity across criminal and political lines. With theft prevented by revolutionary atmosphere, rations stretched further. When generals came to negotiate, they entered under white flags and submitted to body searches by Ukrainian girls, a remarkable reversal of Gulag power. As negotiations stalled, prisoners faced custodians across a deep moat. The last crumbs were gone. Young observers at windows reported camp movements. These 20-year-olds, determined to die rather than surrender, were both admired and envied. Late afternoon on the third day brought devastation. Hut 9 surrendered. Watching 250 pathetic figures trail across camp brought tears. Polish engineer Jerzy Wojerski, serving his 9th year, cried with rage. "Foreman, don't wake me for supper. I shan't be going." Though always hungry, he climbed to his bunk, faced the wall, and wouldn't rise. prisoners had tasted freedom and remembered what it meant to be human.